live.
Are we live right now?
We are live right now. This is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Mm. I don't know why I need to have other people on the show, but I have chosen on this special live stream election night to have Alison Schrager, who is a policy analyst at the Manhattan Institute and a columnist for Bloomberg, a PhD economist who does risk management by trade, right?
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alison. And we have Camille Foster, who's one of the co-conspirators of The Fifth Column.
Yes.
And a founder or co-founder of Freethink Media, which is
Just go by Freethink now, actually.
Why? Are you no longer media?
We still make media, but it's actually, I don't know. I didn't make the decision, if I'm honest.
But aren't you the guy in charge?
I mean, do you think they let me do anything or make decisions? I don't even have a title anymore.
They just pimp you out, right?
Pretty much.
I get that. Okay, so it's election night. We're doing a live stream. And I guess, you know, it's too early to know for sure what's going on, but let's start with a very newsy question. Camille, do you have a sense of when the dust settles, who's going to be president?
I have no idea, and I do not do prognostication anymore. Ever since I got the Trump 2016 primary call completely wrong, insisting that he couldn't possibly win, I've just decided not to do that anymore. I'm out of that game. Absolutely. Okay. I find it all kind of fascinating. I wish it were a little less intense for so many people. Mm-hmm. I will say that I think in the next 4 years, we'll probably have another election, and whoever wins tonight,
that's a bold statement, right? Because both sides have said that this is the last election if the other one wins.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Alison, what about you? Do you have a sense of things?
No, I really wish people would use this experience to learn something about statistics and modeling. And that, you know, we had all these poll models, because you don't know how people are going to go, how swing voters are going to go, what turnout's going to be. And we have all these empirical models that are based on years of data when we had Obama-Romney elections. Mm. And we're in a new world.
Completely different world.
And this election is crazier than any other. So any model we have, any projection they're making is based on nonsense. So we know nothing.
All right. But if we know nothing, that's a form of wisdom, right?
Well, I'm reflecting a lot how people have problems sitting with uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Everyone's just looking at the data, trying to glean something. It's just take this opportunity to, one, accept that we have no idea.
And it's going to take probably at least a week or so minimum, right, to figure out who actually has won.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I have so...
You're even uncertain about that.
Yeah, we could know in 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Who did you vote for, Alice?
Who did I vote for?
Yeah.
I voted for Trump.
Okay. Why?
Monster.
Why do you feel bad?
Are you a shy Trump voter?
I am.
The last one in existence. It's like the Tasmanian devil or something.
I don't even know if I'd vote for him if I was in a swing state, but I'm just so annoyed with people. And I'm in New York, and it just felt like an act of defiance. Mm.
A defiance of what, though?
Being told that, you know, this is existential risk, and that, you know, thinking anything different was somehow sort of taboo. And again, I don't know if I was in Pennsylvania, if I would have voted differently, but it just sort of felt like the punk rock move.
Yeah. Okay. So what if Trump's agenda, you know, okay, so you're voting against Harris, or you're voting against your neighbors? And we should probably point out your exact address so your neighbors can know where you are.
But, I had a reason. I did have a reason. I desperately, if I had my choice, they would both lose.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Yeah.
But I'm an economist, and that's what I know about. And in theory, I should vote on economic policy, and there's really nothing for me there on either side.
Right.
But in the end, I feel like we can handle 4 years of bad economic policy better than we can handle 4 years of bad foreign policy.
Really?
And I feel like Trump's foreign policy is better.
Okay, so first, you know, let's talk about things, you know, economic policy like tariffs, which are bad, right?
Terrible.
And Trump actually has the ability as president, or the president can unilaterally put some of that into motion.
Mm-hmm. On national security grounds.
Yeah, he's also bad on immigration, right? Which is from an economic point of
view. Although he did tell the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago he wants lots of immigration, just legal immigration.
Right, but he cut legal immigration when he was president as much as he could, and he I mean, I agree. True. That would be interesting, right? If he actually kind of
and now he's saying he wants a green card for everyone with a BA or more.
An AA, actually, yeah, an associate's degree. So
I think he's actually likely to follow through on a promise like that, given the kind of people in his coalition now. Yeah,
like especially Stephen Miller, who is still talking Madison Square Garden.
I'm mostly referring to the kind of cabal of tech executives and VC people, like those personalities who are people who are generally in favor of high-skilled immigration because their industry depends upon it.
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, you're hopeful then, and I guess you are too, Allison, or rather, your argument was that even if Trump does what he says he's going to do economically, we can withstand that compared to...
Well, I mean, not 20% tariffs, but I guess I might be rationalizing that they won't happen. Yeah. And, I mean, granted, he has said he will do that, and he said a lot of things that would be terrible for the economy if he does, but I'm just sort of hoping he won't.
Okay. So in terms of foreign policy, what is your, you know, lay out the case for Trump or against Harris?
Well, I mean, I think it's more, I think she projects a lot of weakness. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I've been saying that I'm thinking about invading Taiwan. If
and I honestly just don't know where she stands. And I'm not sure she knows where she stands. I don't know her view of what America's view of the world should be, how involved we should be in foreign policy. Like, I'm not even convinced she has a view.
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, I actually kind of say I was moved by his Wall Street Journal interview where he told Putin he was going to bomb him if he invaded Crimea. And he's like, we're not going to have to do a blockade on Taiwan because Xi knows I'm crazy.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm like, all right, you know, I mean, I think Coleman Hughes keeps saying it's high risk, high reward.
Right.
You know, I'm a risk taker. And so I feel like.
And you don't mind that Camille and I have children and, you know, it's like that can all just go up, you know, because the risk is worth the reward.
I feel like the risk of perceived weakness is worse.
Okay. Hmm. No, I buy that. What do you think, Camille? You are a non-voter.
I abstained this year, yes.
But normally you vote.
I do. Right. I have voted in the past.
Who'd you vote
for in
2020?
I don't usually vote for members of the two major parties. Yeah. To the extent I do go out and vote, especially when I'm living in someplace like a deep blue state, like New York or California, where I've lived for most of the last couple of years. I mean, I might go out and vote in like the Libertarian primary. I may or may not come out for the general because I'm supporting a candidate who's likely to get 1 or 2% in the race.
Right.
This year, it's certainly one of those things. And I've said this before. I could imagine voting for a moderate Democrat or Republican if it's the right sort of person.
Who is that person? I mean, do they exist?
I don't know. Honestly.
I mean, is it somebody like a Jared Polis or I don't know, Crenshaw? Somebody, if he counts as a you guys.
I've at least had some association with those folks in the past. I think both of them are like decent human beings, and in a race, maybe possibly. I think with this particular race, the two things that I would cite are January 6th with Donald Trump that is like uniquely disqualifying, and with Kamala Harris, quite frankly, her conduct around 2020, when the summer of love, when we were seeing like actual waves of political violence in this country, her conduct there and her vice presidential picks actually completely disqualifying. And I couldn't imagine endorsing either one of those candidates formally, given the fact that, you know, for the statistical probability of my vote changing the election, not particularly high. Okay. It's a moral thing.
Yeah. It's a statistical thing.
The statistical improbability of my vote casting making the difference there is not particularly high.
Right.
So I'm not interested in casting a ballot, which essentially is just kind of a bit of a moral statement here, as opposed to anything like me making this decisive, like I'm casting my ballot and I know this baby is important. It isn't consequential in that respect. The only way in which my vote is consequential in California is to me personally. And personally, I couldn't countenance voting for either one of those people. I do not think either one of them ought to be president.
Right.
I know one of them is likely to be president.
Well, is going to.
But, you know, we'll see.
So we'll see. So this goes back to your uncertainty. We're not even sure if, you know, maybe it's going to be Chase Oliver. Or Joe. I don't know.
I mean,
it goes to the House of
Representatives. There's a lot of time between now and January 6th.
Oh, it is.
You know.
Yes. Let me ask a deeper question, because I don't think any of us are like hardcore partisans, and nobody is like, you know what, like civilization will end if Kamala Harris is elected or if Donald Trump is elected. I've been mulling this over for a while. Like we have been in a long period of end times, like where, oh my God, like this is just, you know, the most important election. Everything is about to go down the toilet, et cetera. Gallup shows in their most recent one of their most recent surveys, they said only 26% of people think the country is going in the right direction. By the same token, about 75% say, you know what, my life is going pretty fucking great and it's actually getting better. Hmm. How do we make sense of this? And like, how does that disconnect find expression in politics that doesn't drive us mad?
I'm interested in your answer to that, Nick.
I don't have a good answer. That's why I'm asking the question. I mean, I'm not sure how to answer that, because I also think there's a generational component to this where, you know, millennials and Gen Z are saying, you know, we are the first generation that are going to have a shittier standard of living than our parents. I have heard that my entire life. I was born in 63, so I'm at the end of the baby boom, you know, mm-hmm. beginning of Gen X. Everybody fucking said that all the time. And it's like never been true except for the people who were born maybe, you know, in the 20s and were grown up during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And then that changed. But I don't know. I'm curious, like how, you know, how do we make sense of this? And does it explain why politics is nuts? Like, are we just symbolically projecting everything onto a material reality that's actually pretty good for most people?
I think the material reality is good, but I think the media doomsdays everything. Mm-hmm. So I think everyone's like, this is awful. But I mean, is this, you're saying like Gen Z and millennials actually have a great, they have more wealth. Mm-hmm. They have more human capital because they have more education. Yeah. I mean, we get fixated on the debt, but they also have a lot more human capital. They have more education. Right. So education is correlated with higher wages, more stable wages. I'm like an AI optimist. I think that's going to do great things. I think like the outlook for Gen Z and millennials is better than any other generation. I think every generation does get better, and I think we're still on that trajectory. But they're told constantly things are awful. Mm-hmm. So I think that explains the disconnect.
Yeah, I mean, at a minimum, people tend to be somewhat pessimistic when they look outside of themselves and try to imagine what the future will look like. There's no premium for or no particular price associated with being an AI doomer, for example, and just imagining that the technology is going to wipe out the species in general. And I suppose there's no real cost in being someone who believes, Donald Trump is an existential threat, or Kamala Harris is an existential threat, as you heard from Elon Musk, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
If she's elected, this will be the last election of our life.
And then forget Mars. You know, we're not even going to be able to
go to Mars. Yeah.
Now it's like South America is out of reach.
Yeah, so I don't know how to square that either. Well, I was going to offer a brief answer to your question. Yeah. Like, I am a millennial, I guess, maybe an elder millennial, but I suppose I'm also one of those sandwich generation people. I have a mother who I've been helping and taking care of in many important ways for many, many years. I also have two children. That's a tremendous amount to carry. And I think there are probably a lot more Americans who find themselves in a situation like that, where you may not have them living in the same household as you, in which case you've got a rent to pay in addition to your mortgage, in addition to all of your other things. I can imagine why those people, even being of greater means than their parents were, still feel somewhat stretched and are perhaps looking to the state to give them some sort of assistance, and are perhaps even a little bit more frustrated when they imagine that I could use a bit of help. And the conversations that are happening in national politics from Democratic leaders, for example, are about, well, we need to do something with, you know, the various migrants who are coming into the country and, you know, sending them credit cards and stuff that might be disaffected.
Saying like, hey, you're a first time home buyer, you're getting $25,000.
Right. And also talking about price gouging at grocery stores, I suspect there's a chance that part of the challenge for Kamala was that she didn't do a great job of selling whatever her positive vision is for the economy, because she didn't actually completely pull one together.
Right.
For the most part, she spent a lot of the time insisting that she wasn't Joe Biden and she wasn't Donald Trump.
But she would not change a single thing that he did.
Right.
Right.
And various things that she could have done, presumably, while she was vice president and he was president. If going after price gouging is going to be something you can actually do, if it's achievable, why didn't you do it two, three years ago?
Well, she was busy defending the border. Right.
Her obsession with price gouging, I feel like, speaks to, like I was saying, with foreign policy, she doesn't have philosophy. I don't think she has like a view of the economy. I don't think she has a view of this is how much the state should be involved. This is how much free markets should be involved. I don't think, and this isn't even a criticism, it's just an observation. A lot of people haven't thought deeply about the economy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that
Donald
Trump
running president,
yeah.
right? I mean, you know, like she's about to be president. Well, like, and her father, granted, he was a Marxist economist, but he was an economist. You would think that
he had a view.
She would have imbibed some of that.
Is it Jamaican Marxist? Marxist. Let's just be very clear about exactly what that kind of Marxist.
What does that mean? Is he?
I don't know. He had a penchant for reggae, one presumes. But
yeah. Although he kind of talked trash about that. Right?
About reggae?
Did he? Or about reggae or about ganja or something?
Well, about ganja. Yeah, the two are not the same. There is a connection between.
Like
them,
Trump has a view. I mean, yeah. I don't agree with his view on the economy, right. but it's well articulated as understood. Yeah. I feel like even I could see Obama sitting around with Austin Goolsbee and debating the economy, learning about it. Mm-hmm. He had a view.
Right.
Just, with her, I just don't get a sense of a deep
interest. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to have ever really intersected with any of her professional kind of activities, even though she's been a politician all of her life. I mean, it's...
Well, she's just been so many different politicians. I watched a speech of hers from 2011, shortly after she'd published her book about being smart on crime. This is during the period when she was happy to try to jail parents for having their kids miss school. Yeah. Like, that was a very different Kamala Harris. No, like, the kinds of things she would say at the time was explicitly that our political commitments are making it hard for us to make smart decisions about policy. We're making these kind of we're making criminal justice reform this ideological issue, which that is specifically an attack on the kind of Black Lives Matter movement, which would be ascendant only a few years later.
Which she would,
and you fast forward, and she wants to defund the police. Like, it's rather remarkable to see just how much she's vacillated, and the fact that she wouldn't talk and has come back again, but will not talk about the fact that she's come back again, which again makes it really, really hard to trust this person. I'm all for.
By the way, I want to live in an America where parents are calling their kid, calling the police on their kid. Like, this fucking kid won't go to school.
He won't go to school.
Yeah, it's like 9:30.
It's not me.
You know, I got to start cooking. Get the hell out of here. What, you know, both of them, and I'm the Tax Foundation, Committee on a Responsible Federal Budget, a bunch of other places have all scored kind of their programs because they haven't really, you know, this, you know, as much as talking about like polling in the past, the idea that politicians come up with a platform that they sell, you know, and they hand out something is gone, right? But so neither Trump nor Harris has laid out the plan of what they're going to do. But the Tax Foundation, among others, have looked, you know, they've kind of tallied it up. And what they show is that in terms of spending or at spending and at additions to the debt, Trump's the mid-range estimate is something like $7.8 trillion. Harris, it's like $4.5 trillion or something like that. So each of them is going to spend a boatload of money that is borrowed. Is that just the way it's going to go from now until the end of the American empire, Allison? I mean, from an economic point of view, like where, you know, 15 years ago, there was some discussion at least of, you know, reeling in federal spending. And that just does not seem to be on the table at all.
Well, they would like it to go on forever. It's just the fact is, I mean, interest rates are going up. I mean, even very left-wing people are conceding we're going to higher for longer. Interest rates got very low, so borrowing seemed free for like about a good 20 years. Mm-hmm. That's coming to an end. Aging population, entitlements, foreigners have less need to buy our debt. The people who are buying our debt tend to be investors who want higher rates. Yeah. So at a certain point, I mean, what is like it's... interest rate payments are projected to be 5-6%. That's assuming rates are going to only stay at 4%.
Right.
If they go up higher, all of a sudden this starts eating into other things we want to spend.
But does it? Because we're now, I mean, like the era of $5 trillion federal budget seems to be over and it's going to be $6 trillion and up.
Well, we only have so much money we can spend each year. And we're spending more.
Really?
More, increasingly more. I mean, not yet.
Yeah.
But, I said, like in another... what was it like less than 10 years? We've got entitlements being underfunded. We're probably just gonna be like, oh, let's just do more debt with that. So
there it will come a point where it's like, okay, we really can't print money, we can't manufacture money the way that we have been doing for the past 25, 30 years.
We actually have to make choices. I just wrote a column about this that, you know, if you look at tax rates, they've just, for all but the wealthiest people, been going down, while our spending has been going up. And everyone's sort of, I think, both. parties have sort of been going along with this, but I think time runs out on that. Maybe I was calling this is the last administration or tax reform in 2025, which has to happen because we have to deal with the Trump tax reform.
And that is because of budget, the way things are budgeted, everything gets done for 10 years at a time, and then it has to be renewed.
Well, when we passed the tax cuts in 2017, they sunset in 2015.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, he is like, I want to make it permanent. Kamala's like, I want to make it permanent for 98% of the population.
Right.
So
what is the problem with having, you know, the vast majority of people paying no income tax?
Well, I mean, I personally would like to live in a world where we pay no income taxes, but we do have a government we have to pay for.
Yeah.
And people don't like consumption taxes, which would be my preferred way of taxation. So, you know, in theory, it would be great if people didn't pay taxes, but things the government people want. And it doesn't match up with the government people are willing to pay for.
Right. And, you know, the more people who are not paying in taxes, it's kind of like, yeah, I'll you know, give me the guacamole on top of the burrito, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's 45 cents extra. And if I'm paying out of my own pocket, I'm like, no, no, well, you know what? I'll just dream of guacamole.
It didn't get enough attention. But I mean, Kamala's like suggested that Medicare add in long-term care. I mean, which is great. I mean, especially if you have aging parents. But that's like a really expensive entitlement.
Yeah. Sure.
It's like on par with like adding in prescription drugs.
Right.
And everyone's just sort of like, great.
Which also, by the way, went to people who really didn't need it. And, you know, I was having a conversation earlier. It's worth remembering that both Bush and Gore ran on promising free drugs for elderly people. And Gore even went so far as to say his mother had to make choices between cat food and her prescription drugs. And he was like a multimillionaire from like Earth in the Balance.
That's my money, I mean, Mom.
But that is, yeah, that is like paradigmatic of how we deal with entitlements where people who, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, everybody deserves whatever they fucking paid into the government, et cetera. But it's like, it's not about taking care of people who need help. It's about gilding the lily, you know, whatever. Camille, in the last couple of minutes that we have together, I want to ask you, how do we build a consensus to start talking, not just talking about reducing government, but actually like what has to happen for people to start saying, okay, you know what, we really need to stop spending so much money?
I mean, I think there actually has to be some austerity. Like people have to feel some kind of meaningful pain in their lives associated with spending and actually make the connection between it's the spending, it's the size and scope of government, as opposed to, well, it's the rich that aren't paying their fair share. And at the moment, I think that that latter statement, the rich not paying their fair share, generally resonates with people a lot more powerfully. I would I suspect that even amongst like the Republican populace,
that
people have to adopt a different sort of perspective, either that or there's so much political pressure
How do we bring that perspective?
I wish I knew.
Like, how do we educate people or how do we convince people? I guess the other question then, and this is an interesting one, everybody is talking about, and it seems fairly convincing that, you know, one of the things that we're seeing is a shift from the Republican Party of a kind of wealthier, college educated, higher income, you know, party to one of what is oftentimes called the working class. But it's basically people who don't have college degrees, but they might have a lot of money, actually. I mean, these things are not as tightly correlated as one might expect. How does that change things if the Democratic Party becomes the party of kind of highly educated elites and the Republican Party becomes the party of like working class Joes?
Well, I think we already see this because remember when it was Obama, he's like, I will not increase taxes anyone who makes more than $250,000. Now we're up to 400 grand.
Right.
I mean, on what planet is 400 grand make you middle class?
None.
It's the 90th percentile. Yeah.
Maybe Mars.
So I think we're
planet Manhattan.
Yeah.
It's still pretty expensive here.
Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't get you far here, but does everywhere else. So, I mean, or in DC too. So I think we already see that. And the fact that once you get above the 98th percentile, I think you do get the split again with crazy rich people. So, I mean, we already see that with that somehow we've redefined middle class as people make $400,000.
Yeah. So, I mean, politically, how does that play out though? Then does is Trump onto something by saying, I'm going to do tariffs and that's going to reestablish manufacturing in America, which peaked in the 40s? I mean, is that a convincing political ploy, even if it doesn't actually change where people work or what kind of jobs they have?
I mean, perhaps, although I'm not even sure that the voters he's going after want manufacturing jobs either. Mm-hmm. I think there is just sort of, you know, a romance with the idea that we should make things again. But I'm not sure anyone actually wants to be the one to make things.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there a constituency who's cheering for tariffs when he talks about them? I mean, they may cheer when he talks about it, but I don't know that they're actually like, and I mean, I'm really looking forward to those 20% tariffs. It's amazing. It's kind of remarkable that that is such a huge talking point for him, because I just don't imagine that there's an actual constituency for it.
Is it? I mean, but it's wrapped up in the idea that I am going to make America great again, again.
And this is how I make those people pay.
Yeah. And it is like, it's those of us, you know, and when he says that, I'm assuming he's like, Alaska and Hawaii really aren't part of America, but it's the contiguous United States. And like, it's us against them. And it's all part of a wall, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, literal and figurative.
Sure. I mean, I suppose that's possible. It just, it strikes me as somewhat strange. I think when we first started talking, you said that Trump has this kind of coherent economic philosophy. But in truth, like, there's the kind of gimmickry around taxes and there is the tariff stuff. And I suppose it's kind of coherent, but for me, it feels rather nebulous, and I don't actually know which parts of it to take seriously.
It's coherent to me. It's wrong in a lot of areas, but it's coherent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bring manufacturing back. There's the deregulation, which is nice. Lower taxes and taxes. I think in his head, the cost of tariffs are borne by China. Not true.
It's like Mexico will pay for the wall.
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, I don't know that he has a coherent, you know, whether it's convincing or not, I'm not sure it's coherent, but it is an impulse, which is making money is good. A lot of economic activity is good. He's not ashamed of being rich.
And he's very comfortable with debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that is particularly if it's somebody else's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? So I guess you know what? As a final thing, and we're going to bring in a couple of new people because you guys
we're used up.
Yeah. You're just hustling yourself like all of us after in this weird 21st century. What is there anything that you are most concerned about unfolding over the next 4 years?
I would like to see journalism regain its sensibility. Broadly speaking, I think that the Trump years, and I don't mean just the four he was in office, but the Trump years in general have coincided with a real loss of a sense of just what journalism is and what it's supposed to be and what it's supposed to do. And there's so many people who are kind of crusading activists now who used to believe in something like objective journalism. I would love to see that snap back. And I'm a little concerned that if Trump manages to win, that the derangement that you've seen in certain places and the pivot towards this kind of moral clarity, activist journalism, will continue in a kind of unrelenting way, and they may even double down.
Who is a journalistic hero of yours, or even better than a hero, who's like, what's a platform that you think, you know, epitomize the type of journalism you think we need more?
Well, I can talk about people who do a pretty good job today. I mean, and this is no bullshit. I mean, Reason Magazine is a reliable standard bearer, and I think it's useful to have publications that have a particular ideological, philosophical commitment. And Semaphore is another really good publication that I think is doing really great work and is trying to use mechanisms to actually put their values into practice, giving you a sense of transparency, separating the views of the journalist, but actually putting them there so that you can have some sense about that, so that they can actually try to report the news in a more straightforward way, showing that they trust their audience. And
that's helpful. I mean, because we're in a continual decline of trust and confidence in institutions.
But I mean, the trust from the publication to its audience is actually part of that. It's the fulcrum that I think some of that twists upon. So. Yeah, I'm a little concerned about that, but I also see some green shoots, and I hope we see improvements in that over the next 4 years and not just
green
more
shoots.
Of the same.
That's a classic phrase, you know, which I always think of Mount St. Helens. Like a year after it blew up, there are like green shoots, like crocuses growing.
That's probably not a bad metaphor.
Allison, what is there a concern that you have that overwhelms you? You had mentioned foreign policy before.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not an expert on that.
Yeah.
Like Emil, if Trump does win, I think he does have a way of melting people's brains and making things more divisive. And I don't think we need that. Mm-hmm. So that's bad. Also, I think markets are going to come to the realization that interest rates aren't going back to zero. Mm. I think that involves a big structural.
Wow, that is such a huge. I mean, I'm old enough to remember like double digit inflation or interest rates,
yeah,
and things like that. And where credit cards, you know, it's like 18%, 21% APR, all of that kind of stuff. It has been so long since interest
going that high. But
but I mean, even if you're creeping up to like 5, 6, 7, 8.
You know, I think we're going back there. And I think the
economy. Is that good economically, though? I mean, it concentrates the mind a little bit, right?
It has advantages and has disadvantages depending on who you are in the economy. The bigger issue is that we have an economy that's been built on zero rates.
Mm-hmm.
So that change can be disruptive.
Yeah.
But the actual being there, as it has advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah. Okay. Allison Schrager, the Manhattan Institute, Bloomberg. Thank you for talking to me at this live election night watch party.
Yes.
Camille Foster of Free Think.
Yes.
Period or asterisk.
Right? It's just Free Think. Yeah.
And the Fifth Column. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
We'll be
thank
talking
you, Nick.
To you
thanks to Reason.
You're going
to
exit, and hopefully they're going to keep the camera trained on me so that you don't see the unfortunate and awkward position. Okay, we're bringing in a couple other people. Where is that extra microphone, by the way?
Right here.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I appreciate that. So ideally what we're going to be doing is, and now you're blocking me. So it's like, but we're going to be talking with Coleman Hughes of the Free Press. We're going to be talking to Peter Meyer, the scion of one of the very best big box stores in America and a former congressman, and Peter Suderman, the features editor of Reason Magazine. So guys, why don't you come on in? Here's Coleman Hughes. All right, please have a seat.
Hello.
If the other gents could come
I
in.
I don't know if they're there, frankly.
Oh, really?
It might just be me and you.
Okay, that's fine.
Maybe they're coming.
Well, let's thank you so much, Camille.
I appreciate it.
Coleman, I have been in this room talking with very very wise people, so I haven't been listening to
now
any
you have to
news.
Talk to me.
What's going on? Do you want to put on headphones? You don't have to.
I prefer not to.
Okay.
I know how to stay close to the mic.
Okay. Coleman, what is your sense of tonight?
This morning, I thought it was too close to call.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Trump had about a week worth of good news from the polls, but then yesterday, Kamala had a day worth of good news, both from Nevada and from Iowa. And to me, it was a wash. My experience tells me that when the betting markets go crazy on the eve of a call, it might mean that insiders have information that is not leaked to the news. So for example, when Kamala Harris was that weekend, she was choosing between Tim Walz and Josh Shapiro.
Yeah.
I thought she would go Josh Shapiro. I thought it made sense. The betting markets were 50-50. They would tick up and slightly up, slightly down based on news stories that came out. And then suddenly, either Sunday night or Monday morning, they started going wild for Josh Shapiro without any news story that would tip off such a rise. Yeah. And I'm fairly sure that was because of insider trading, essentially,
okay,
which is not regulated.
So who'd you vote for?
I didn't vote for president. I found both candidates unacceptable.
All right, that's a common sentiment among me anyway.
That reason, I think it's
Peter, who did you vote for?
I also did not vote. I've only voted once. I am a
really
committed non-voter at this point for various reasons.
Why did you vote once then?
Because it was 2004, and
the most important election of our.
Really.
I grew up in Florida,
yeah,
and in 2000, which was the first election in which I was eligible to vote, I forgot. I filled out of an absentee ballot, and I was in college, and I just forgot to send it in. And we all remember what happened with the absentee ballots that did that came in late.
Did you vote for Pat Buchanan? Or no, I guess I was in the. That was in the final election, right?
And I did not vote for Pat Buchanan. And so like at that point, I was young. I was still sort of figuring out what my politics were and what I thought about them. And having come out of an election in which it seemed like maybe the vote that I didn't cast in 2000 as a Florida absentee voter might have might have played a role in the election. I thought, well, I'm going to vote this time.
So who did you vote for in 2004?
George W. Bush in 2004. Yeah. And look how that turned out. Yeah. I have never voted again. Right. So I don't vote for a couple of reasons. One is that I just don't think most votes count. I think it's mostly an expressive act. And my expression is, I'm not going to spend the time on that. Okay. I'm not going. And also, I'm not going to spend the time to cast a vote for people who I extremely dislike and don't think deserve the office. And then the other thing is, I live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
I am, as a Washington, D.C. voter, my vote really doesn't count. It's not even not a swing state. It is the most blue, most Democratic part of the country. Over the summer, I spent a few months a little bit north of Boston. Mm. The area we were in, I was seeing some Trump signs in the yard, and I asked my wife, you know, maybe are we in something like a little bit of a Trump country? I know Massachusetts is a blue state. Like I'm
not
unaware of this, but maybe this little part of the area is blue, I thought. And it turned out it was like 70-30 Biden in the last election. Oh. But the difference was there were Trump voters. And it was so unusual to me, having lived in Washington, D.C. for almost 20 years, to see any kind of representation for Trump voters, that even a place that was overwhelmingly pro-Biden felt like maybe this is Trump country. Maybe this is a Trump place.
Peter Meyer, former U.S. congressman and scion of the Meyer Superstores, which as somebody who lived for a long time in Oxford, Ohio, and would go to the Meyer Superstore in Hamilton, that was like a real special treat. Thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Okay. And I mean, it's right up there with Target and Walmart, and obviously, you know, I guess you guys helped vanquish Kmart, but it's very good stuff. Who did you vote for?
So I'm the only person from a swing state here, right?
Okay.
I'm the only
vote in Michigan, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure that I'm deep enough in my cups to emotionally process the vote I had to cast today, because as both a Republican but also a Republican who voted to impeach Trump, there's a lot of mixed emotions.
Yeah. Wait, what's mixed about it? Don't you just hate the guy?
It's very good. Okay. It's gin-based. It's excellent.
Did you vote for Trump?
Like I said, I think you can intuit. I did not vote for Kamala Harris. You can take the negative.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, Michigan's a state that Trump won by 10,740 votes in 2016. He lost it by over 150,000 in 2020. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 2024, it looks like he has a very good chance of winning this state again.
Yeah.
I'm trying to read the tea leaves aspiration on MSNBC.
Will you be happy? How much of a Republican are you? Because, there's a lot of crazy Republicans now, right? In a way that 10 years ago, there weren't as many, for sure. I mean, does the Republican Party, is it good if Trump wins and the Republicans control Congress?
You know, when it comes to crazy Republicans, and I think I view the same thing with a lot of, if you look at the ACLU questionnaire that Kamala Harris filled out in 2019, right, a lot of folks just go along to get along.
Yeah.
They look, what is the script I'm supposed to read? They read that script. You know, what's in their heart of hearts can be a completely different thing. And I think you will see a pretty rapid snapback when that is no longer the path of least resistance, when that is something that is more challenging. For me, one of the things I think the president has the greatest control over and what was operative in my decision-making was around foreign policy.
Right.
And frankly, as somebody who was along for the ride for the first 2 years of the Biden administration serving in Congress and just looking at the amount of areas where it was not a policy difference, it was an implementation difference and frankly, the total destruction of our deterrence. And Trump got a lot of crap for, you know, love letters to dictators and all of these things. You know, those love letters were also combined with threats to bomb them, including bombing Beijing, bombing Moscow, and, you know, let alone Pyongyang. And I think the status quo, and then this is where Trump has convinced me of the benefits of a madman theory of foreign policy.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have your adversaries think you're going to bomb them to prevent the situation from ever occurring, as opposed to where we have backslid in so many places under this current administration, where we don't want to do anything, we don't want to escalate, we don't want to do this, we don't want to be engaged, and then we wind up militarily entangled because that was what we were trying to avoid all along, and our adversaries took advantage of that in order to ramp something up and put us in a disadvantageous position.
Okay. Thank you. I want to ask a question of each of you, and I had asked the previous guest. Gallup shows that only about 26% of Americans think the country's going in the right direction, but an equal or an obverse number, about 75% of us say, you know what, my individual situation is good and getting better. How do we make sense of that, and how does that map onto, you know, the politics that we're seeing now going into this, where everybody's under, you know, nobody's a clear winner, and you know, the control of Congress just keeps bouncing back and forth between the two parties.
I think, you know, I love the books by Steven Pinker and Hans Rosling and all these people that say people are too pessimistic. The news benefits financially from reporting only the bad things, never the good things. When was it recently that like one of the major diseases, I don't know if it was malaria or another one, it was like was officially banished from an African country. You'll never hear about that.
Right.
But you hear about, you know, you hear about everything bad going on. And so that's why people say things are terrible.
You hear about the threat of fluoride. Fluoride is wiping out whole communities, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
My gums.
Yeah.
And my tonsils.
Fluoridated water supply in 1946. So just got to give a shout out to Grand Rapids.
Not to give a tangent, but apparently Europe's gotten rid of it. And it's, it seems like
It's not the beginning and end. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I agree.
But the point is, they call it negativity bias.
Yeah.
I think they're correct about that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know anyone whose grandparent didn't have a worse life than them.
Yeah.
And we're still riding that trend. So big picture, I'm optimistic about humanity, but we still do need good leadership. Good leadership matters.
It's absolutely
it's crazy that our two choices are these.
Yeah, it's embarrassing, right?
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, so
you and I both know probably like 10 people in our phone contacts that might be better presidents than both of these people, and yet,
yeah,
the first 50 names in the phone book.
Probably all of us know.
Post office most wanted list could be better. What is your biggest fear over the next, coming out of this election, do you have a fear that is percolating?
It's my fear for Trump is partly his own, you know, the low percentage chance that he makes some erratic decision. He's in the room talking to his Secretary of State, Defense, National Security Advisor. They're all telling him, no, don't do it. And he just does it anyway.
Yeah.
And it has some terrible consequence. He's capable of doing that. With Kamala, I worry about the fact that her clear, literally, I don't think there's 10 seconds in her entire campaign since July where she said anything impressive about any foreign policy issue. Literally not 10 seconds.
Maybe also not any domestic policy issues.
Yes. Yes. Although she said
very little.
I think she's versed enough in domestic policy to not be crazy or really stupid.
She manages Democratic coalitions well.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that she's
always. She's American. She gets, I don't know if she gets foreign policy. And so
ironic if she's like super American because she does have her parents were both immigrants, right?
Yeah. But just to answer your question, I think
I
worry about China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, what they're going to get up to in the world with her as president scares me.
Yeah. Okay. Peter?
So I think if you think about people think their situation is pretty good, but they think the country is on the wrong track. You can relate that back to, this is a common thing that that Americans say about a lot of different issues. Mm-hmm. So I've written a lot about healthcare, and if you go back to the Obamacare debates, one of the things that was really interesting was people thought that the American healthcare system was a disaster. but most people really liked their own health insurance. Right, right. It was also true, historically, it has been true, that most people think their congressman is pretty good.
Right.
But congressional, the approval ratings for
People like Meyer on mass, right? Single digits. I mean, like terrible approval rate. But that is right, fascinating. So
a brand new trend. Right. And we have seen this in many dimensions beforehand. And so the way that I think about this is to go back to the thing that I was saying earlier, which is that voting, especially for president, is an expressive act.
Right.
And so when you vote for Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, it's not that people are not voting for real consequences, but people feel like what they are voting for is, this is the sensibility that I think best defines America. And right now, the sensibility I think that a lot of people want is a pre-COVID America. And Donald Trump is a better avatar of pre-COVID America because he was president before COVID happened and because Americans were broadly satisfied with the economy and the way a lot of things were going before COVID. And you see that not so much in the polls that ask people, what is your most important issue? The big issues are inflation and immigration, but inflation shot up because of COVID and because of the policy response to COVID. Frustrations with immigration are in large part a frustration with the fact that inflation is happening, and it feels like, if the economy is bad, then all these foreigners here, all these other people who are maybe feel a little bit different than me, that feels like they're taking something away. They're making the economy worse. Right. They are part of this. They're taking something away from the economic pie of real America.
So, and do you think then part of the Democrat or Harris's response to that, kind of broadly speaking, is to say, no, you're wrong to feel that way? It's an invalidation of people saying the border is chaotic. I feel like I'm getting ripped off.
That's absolutely what the Biden administration has been saying. And so if you go back to 2023, starting in the summer of 2023, Joe Biden toured the country giving speeches saying Bidenomics is working. And he specifically said, look, we're going to start with the American Rescue Plan and then the CHIPS and Science Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, the three big pieces of economic policy. He said, look, it's not just that the economy is pretty good. It's that it's pretty good because of these three pieces of legislation that I put my name on, that I pressed for, that I passed, and people didn't buy it. It was actually amazing. You start in the summer of 23 when he started touring, and you look at perceptions of the economy, they got worse as he was touring, saying the economy is great.
Yeah, he was like an 80s band. He was like the Cars in their last tour. It was like people are like, now we're done.
Talking heads after 1985.
What's your big fear?
Big fear is that neither of these candidates seems prepared for a crisis in totally different ways. Mm-hmm. Trump seems unprepared because he's a maniac, because he's unreliable, because he's somebody who just makes decisions based on his whims and his grievances. Kamala Harris seems unprepared because she is somebody who has never proven herself as being decisive and capable in the moment in a position of governance. She rose up because she is good at playing an inside game in the Democratic Party power structure, but not because she is somebody who has demonstrated that she can make good decisions when it counts.
Right. Okay. Peter Meyer, are people's lives getting better? And they're just recalcitrant in admitting that?
Well, I mean, I think what we need to factor in here is the question is right track, wrong track, right? Mm-hmm. The track is the trajectory. Right? And so even if your individual circumstances at this moment may be comfortable, may be okay, that question is, do you feel like you'll be in a better position 5 years or 10 years from now on the way we're on? And more importantly, frankly, do you feel like your kids will have the same opportunities that you had? And I think especially on the affordability issues, and this is where the impact of inflation on interest rates and specifically on housing, I think has been a massively underreported story in this country. I mean, Harris is saying she's going to give $25,000 to first-time home
buyers. Right?
I mean,
it's also true that Gen Z and millennials are buying houses at rates that are basically equal to Gen X. I mean, there's so much slippage, it seems to me, between material reality as we can kind of understand it and people's attitudes towards it. Like when I hear Gen Z people, like if you're 25 and you're saying, I can't afford a house, it's like, no fucking kidding. Right? I mean, like, in what world do you live in where you think you deserve a house at 25?
Well, and this is where I think it's their frame of reference oftentimes isn't 30 years ago. Yeah. It's 5 years ago.
Right.
Right. It is what you remember, right? When it comes to inflation, the Biden administration continuously is like, oh, we've gotten inflation back within the band that we were aiming for. Okay. But from a consumer standpoint, you don't care that it's only going up now 2%. Right. It used to be 5%. Mm-hmm. You want prices to go back to the way they were. Now, obviously, that's economically not the reality. That would be deflationary. The other problems come in there.
It's human psychology.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, I remember when I moved to New York, like a chicken and rice at a halal cart was $7. Mm-hmm. And I remember because I used to get it all the time. And now it's $10. Yeah. So that's how people think.
I've seen, you know, when Subway gave up the $5 foot long, it was like, oh, my God. Like, it's a new dark age. But it's weird.
And yet, we've also seen a response to this from companies, particularly fast food companies, which have dropped prices for certain types of deals. Yeah. I mean, McDonald's in particular has introduced a $5 deal. Right? So, look.
And Subway now has a foot long pretzel. Like, so everything.
We
can't keep prices down, so we're going to make them longer.
About our favorite fast food deals at this point.
Well, I'm a Jimmy John's fan. I'm true to living in the Midwest for a long time. Jimmy John's sandwiches, it's food so fast you'll freak. We need to wrap up. Peter Meyer. And the vegetarian sub is delicious. There is a couple in New York, by the way, and near Newark Airport. Peter Meyer, do you have a big fear coming out of this election, other than that you're going to be in Congress again, and you're going to have to vote to impeach Trump? You remind me, if I may, and I'm sorry if this is kind of a history lesson, but Jeanette Raskin was the first elected congresswoman from Montana or Idaho. She got into office, was voted against World War I, and got wiped out. Like, it was very unpopular. She clawed her way back up, and then was the only person who voted against the U.S. entry into World War II, and that was like it. So that could be you.
Well, let's certainly hope this second Trump term doesn't echo World War I in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, or does it last that long? Yeah.
No. I mean, I very much sympathize and am with Coleman on that fear on the foreign policy side.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you the amount of times I had NATO ambassadors who despise Trump with every fiber of their being. When they look at something the Biden administration did, they would turn and say, God, I wish Trump were here. Or even, I had a BBC News reporter telling me the problem that the Biden administration has is that the Taliban don't fear being bombed by them. Right. There is something to be said for at least outwardly projecting that and not shrinking back. I think Trump got a bad rap in terms of being isolationist and sort of the insular American. And that may have been rhetorically true, but it was not true in practice or in understanding.
How far are we from, and I suspect you and I and all of us at this table have differing views on foreign policy, exactly, but we have not had a discussion about foreign policy or like what is America's role in the world for a long time. I mean, arguably since the end of the Cold War, but certainly even in the War on Terror and stuff like that, it kind of got glommed on and then just became amorphous and inchoate. So what has to happen for an actual conversation about foreign policy that builds a consensus in the country?
Well, I mean, you need foreign policy to not be like every other policy where it gets dragged into the partisan morass, right? It does not do well in the high pressure lights or the Klieg lights of media. But I think the challenge that we have to wrap our minds around is we have had low intensity conflicts, over the past three decades. We obviously, going back to Vietnam, to Korea, those were in some ways conventional wars, but the fatality count was not to a point. And the opening salvos, if God forbid, we enter a war with China, we will probably see more American service members killed in the first week than were killed in Vietnam or Korea as individual conflicts. I mean, I think that is the challenge, is we do not appreciate how much we stand on a knife's edge and how much other actors may be willing to test our willingness to endure atrocity and horror. And I don't want to test that. I want to reestablish that deterrence. And I, frankly, after watching this administration and understanding who will likely staff a Harris administration, I have zero confidence that they will have an appreciation for the world as it is, as opposed to the world they want it to be. Mm-hmm. And that mismatch can be fatal.
All right, we are going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Coleman Hughes of the Free Press, as well as Conversations with Coleman. Where else should people?
CNN.
That's right. So you're part of the problem, right? It's part of the problem, that was a vast crumbling empire, right, of legacy media. It's Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine, and also Cocktails with Suderman, a very big Substack. Okay. And Peter Meyer, where should people look for you?
You can find me on Twitter at RepMeyer, M-E-I-J-E-R, or you can patronize our fine stores in Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin.
What's hot these days at the Meyer store? Like, what's flying off the shelf?
Craft whiskey.
Really? Okay. Not available at all stores in all
Meyer
states.
Is
right.
To
yeah.
Sell it.
Yeah, that is.
Right?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a combination, mostly three tier, but not all.
Yeah. Okay. That is going to wrap it up for this election night watch party version of the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I do, now that I think about it, I want to plug a great book that came out a couple of years ago, Tomorrow the World by Stephen Wertheim, who's a foreign policy expert. It's a history of the isolationist movement. Which is very interesting and is very different than anything you read about it. I highly recommend it. It's very valuable now to think about that. But we're wrapping up. Thank you for tuning in to the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Go read Reason, reason.com. And thank you very much.